There has been a number of agencies that have come up with plans, but there's been no money to actually start.
Residents of Shaktulik take action to protect their community from erosion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a voting rights case wraps up in federal court in Anchorage.
They've also had lots of documents, lots of emails where election workers are either not there or not doing what they need to do.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
A lawsuit over whether or not the state of Alaska's Division of Elections has adequately met the needs of native language speakers for election materials is winding down in a federal court in Anchorage. Richard Maurer of the Anchorage Daily News has been following the case and joins us now. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Yesterday, Elections Director Gail Fanumiai took the stand. She was the state's last witness. What did she have to say?
Well, yeah, between yesterday and she's actually finished up this morning, she defended the record of the agency, said that they've tried very hard to get bilingual poll workers, for instance. Sometimes the situation they find there, some of the poll workers are not always reliable in terms of going to training. She said the most important thing, even if we don't train them, to open the polls. And so they'll open polls regardless of whether workers are trained. She also acknowledged that the language assistance provided to Yupik speakers, and particularly Gwich'in speakers, is far less than even what's given to Spanish speakers and Tagalog speakers from the Philippines.
Well, what about the plaintiff's witnesses? How have they made their case that native language speakers are having difficulty understanding materials or getting proper translations?
Two different kinds of witnesses. They've had expert witnesses who are language experts and cultural experts, people who have studied this issue. And they've had some witnesses who have testified that the assistance is not what they need. But they've also had lots of documents, lots of emails where election workers are either not there or not doing what they need to do. And also they've grilled state's witnesses who have acknowledged either the difficulty or the failure to provide ballot measure translations, those kinds of things.
Has there been evidence presented on either side about how this is handled in other states where there are concentrated populations of non-English first speakers?
There's been some evidence presented about how it's handled on reservations outside in terms of what some of the experts have said, but there's not been a lot. I think that as far as other languages other than native languages, I think there's been a strong case that the state does translate much more material into the written languages of Spanish and Tagalog than it makes available in terms of Yupik and Gwich'in, in part because the state says, you know, these are traditionally oral languages. There isn't really a written language tradition in these languages. The plaintiffs, the natives, say that, well, these languages have actually been written in one form or another for years, and lots of people understand the written languages, the written version of these languages.
And Richard, has the judge made any comments that give insight into how this may go?
Well, she's initially said that the state needs to provide the same kind of materials in Gwich'in and in Yupik that it provides to voters in English and the other languages. The state's contended that because these are oral languages, we do provide the same kind of assistance, even if the material, the absentee ballot instructions, the voter pamphlet, the announcements, even if those materials are not all translated into the native languages, they do provide bilingual poll workers who are there to assist voters who come to the polls and have trouble understanding something. That's the state's position. The plaintiffs say, well, if you do that, people have to ask. They may be embarrassed about asking, or the translations may not be consistent.
Richard Maurer is a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News. It could be weeks before Judge Gleason releases her decision. For years, agency reports have listed Shaktulik as eroding with immediate need for relocation. But without government funding, little action has taken place and erosion has progressed. Now the people of Shaktulik are taking matters into their own hands to protect their community. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
A four-foot-high pile of driftwood lines the coast of Shaktulik. It stretches 1 mile from the first house to the dump. The barrier's the city's first step in building a coastal berm, and it's the community's first defense for fall storm surges.
If we try and wait for any kind of federal money, it's going to take more than a while to get this thing started. So we decided it's time for us to do something on our own.
That's Harvey Sukiuk, one of the crew members constructing the berm. Coordinating the project is Eugene Asisik. He's the mayor of Shaktulik and the vice chair of the Shaktulik Native Corporation.
There has been a number of agencies that have come up with plans, but there's been no money to actually start.
Over the years, Asisik says, a parade of government and private agencies have landed in the community to assess the erosion. He says they investigate, write a report, and leave. Two examples are in 2008, the state's Immediate Action Work Group released a report classifying Shaktulik as one of 8 communities in Alaska, quote, in greatest peril due to climate change. Then in 2009, the Federal Government Accountability Office listed Shaktulik as one of 4 Alaska communities, quote, likely needing to move all at once and as soon as possible from continued flooding and erosion.
But again, there is no money. That's where we've taken the initiative upon ourselves.
That initiative is a coastal berm. Over the past 2 years, the community has saved and raised money to build it. $620,000 total from the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation in community development funds and an outside entity grant. Asisik says they're going to work until the money runs out, about 3 months. The funds will pay for labor, equipment, and fuel. It won't pay for an engineer. Instead, Shaktulik is basing the berm's design off a blueprint from the Department of Transportation. The DOT had intended to construct a vegetated berm in Shaktulik as an experiment for other eroding communities. Shaktulik lifted that design just without the vegetation.
I would love to, but it's not in the budget and the money doesn't allow it.
DOT coastal engineers Harvey Smith and Ruth Carter drafted the design and support the community's efforts.
They're kind of taking our idea and making it happen in a bigger way than what we could do with our little grant.
The berm will consist of a driftwood pile embedded with gravel backed by a gravel mound. Both materials come from the Shaktulik coast. Though the community is paying to construct the berm, if the barrier gets damaged, the state or FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, might be responsible for repairing it. Jeremy Zedek is the Public Information Officer for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
This berm, if it was owned by the city, it was properly engineered and maintained as a protective measure for the community, it can be eligible under public assistance program.
The berm's construction is in its second week. To date, the workers have piled the driftwood and finished cutting a road to begin hauling the gravel. Here's Asisik.
Yes, we could just sit here and see what happens, but I can't. I personally can't. So in a way, we are taking our own fate.
Asisik says he doesn't know how long the berm will last. At best, he says the barrier will prevent a surge from cresting into the community. If anything, he says, it will buy the community time. Time to remain in Shaktulik, or just time to escape the storm. In Shaktulik, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
More than $270,000 in federal funds will help relocate five homes in Huslia following flooding and erosion on the Koyukuk River last month. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development authorized the money under its imminent threat funds. It supplements another $85,000 in funds from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to cover the full $356,000 in cost. The Athabascan village of 320 people is located about 250 miles west of Fairbanks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the ANB Harbor in Sitka gets a facelift.
I've been here, you know, over 50 years, and I don't remember them ever, doing any major work to the old ANB Harbor. Yeah, it's really nice. Everything's brand new.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
The honor flag, an American flag that travels the country honoring those that lost their lives in the line of duty, arrived in Anchorage on Tuesday, just in time for the 4th of July weekend. APRN's Joaquin Palomino has the story.
Shortly after September 11th, 2001, Chris Heisler traveled from Texas to New York to hang an American flag where the World Trade Center once stood. That flag has since been dubbed the Honor Flag. Heisler says it has traveled more than 7 million miles to pay tribute to those that have died serving the United States.
You know, this flag represents everything that's true about what's great about this nation and the emotions. This flag brings out in so many people. It's amazing.
This 4th of July weekend, Heisler brought the flag to Anchorage, and for the first time, people will be allowed to handle it.
We have brand new custom gloves that are used to handle the U.S. Honor Flag, and we're going to allow the general public to take pictures and handle the U.S. Honor Flag with the gloves. This is a unique opportunity that's never been afforded to anyone in the nation.
The flag will be part of the 4th of July parade. In Anchorage, I'm Joaquin Palomino.
Last month, the Canadian government gave conditional approval to the Northern Gateway pipeline in British Columbia. If it's built, it'll bring hundreds more oil tankers through the Bering Sea. That's putting pressure on the Aleutian Islands to get ready for an increase in vessel traffic. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
Canada's government set out more than 200 conditions for the tar sands pipeline to meet before it moves forward. Many relate to spill prevention, but they don't extend as far as the Bering Sea. Leslie Pearson is project manager for the Aleutian Islands Risk Assessment. She estimates the pipeline would bring about 200 more tankers a year through already crowded Unimak Pass. As development spurs traffic across the Aleutians, Pearson's group is preparing to release its report on how to keep the region safe.
We'll have a draft report for the risk assessment that identifies the recommendations for building an optimum response system, and that includes the towing, offshore distances, response, salvage, marine firefighting capabilities for the Aleutian region.
The report is more than 5 years in the making. Among other things, it'll propose that trans-Pacific tankers stay 50 miles from shore throughout the Aleutian Islands. Pearson says that would give rescue tugs more time to reach a disabled tanker before it ran aground.
Right now, some vessels are transiting a lot closer to the island chain, which, you know, time is of the essence, and there's a great distance out there. And so the intent here is to push them further offshore, provide more time, and hopefully prevent any sort of accidents from occurring.
The risk assessment will also recommend stationing rescue tugs in Unalaska, ADAC, or both. And it asks for more cleanup and salvage tools on those islands, including a large tank barge to offload fuel from other vessels. Ships traveling to and from Northern Gateway would do so in Innocent Passage. If they're not stopping at an American port, they're not really subject to American rules for spill prevention. But Pearson says more monitoring would help keep them in check. Tankers stopping at ports in Alaska have to join the State Maritime Prevention Network's satellite tracking program. Starting this year, Pearson says large container ships do too.
They've been able to contact vessels when they, you know, decide that they're going to slow down and do donuts out in the Pacific or in some sort of close proximity just to bide time. The eye in the sky, I think, has been really pivotal.
That program's still voluntary for foreign vessels not stopping en route across the Pacific, but Pearson hopes tankers like those that would travel to Northern Gateway would buy in. The risk assessment report won't have much else to say about cost. Pearson says it shows the economic benefit in protecting the region's fisheries from harm, but it doesn't address the price of new equipment. She says they'll use the recommendations to ask federal and private sources for help. The report is due out August 1st. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The Air Force has agreed to delay its plans to demolish the $300 million HAARP research facility near Glen Allen to allow more time to work out a deal to transfer ownership to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Air Force Secretary Deborah James told Senator Lisa Murkowski Wednesday that the service will halt dismantling the so-called HAARP facility until May 2015. HAARP stands for High Frequency Active Auroral Research Program. It's used to conduct experiments on the Earth's ionosphere. The delay is good news for Bob McCoy. He's the director of UAF's Geophysical Institute, and he and officials with other universities and science agencies have been negotiating with the Pentagon for more than a year now to hand over the HAARP.
We've been reaching out across the country trying to represent the scientific communities to say to the U.S. government, hey, this is important. This is the most exquisite facility of its kind. Please don't destroy it.
UAF already owns a share of the HAARP facility, along with the Air Force, Navy, and Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, or DARPA. The 30-acre facility includes an array of 180 high-power transmitting antennas that alter the Earth's ionosphere to affect auroral displays and test communications and surveillance technologies, among other things. McCoy says university officials and others in the scientific community decided to seek full ownership of the HAARP facility after the Air Force announced last year that it no longer needed it and would scrap it. David Walker is the Air Force's Deputy Assistant Secretary for Science, Technology, and Engineering. He told Murkowski during a Senate Appropriations Subcommittee hearing in May that the service intended to dismantle the HAARP facility this summer to avoid winterization costs.
We would like to get the critical equipment out of the site before the winter, the harsh winter in Alaska. Does lead to a very costly winterization to maintain the site, and we'd like to avoid that if we can.
McCoy says he's hopeful the UAF consortium can work out a deal. He says his immediate concern is to halt the dismantling and removal of diagnostic equipment that monitors the effects of the high-power antennas.
You need diagnostic instruments, optical radars, to see what's been happening, to do the science.
It wasn't clear Wednesday whether the Air Force has or will halt the dismantling of that part of the facility. Walker told Murkowski in the May hearing that the Air Force would consider handing over the facility, but not if it was required to continue funding its operation and maintenance.
We have gotten interest from the university in Fairbanks. However, the interest we have is that they will run it if we fund it, which is unfortunately in this fiscal environment we're in right now, this is not an area that we have any need for in the future and don't see that it would be good use of Air Force S&T funds in the future.
McCoy says he and the other researchers know they'll have to operate the HAARP facility on a tight budget. He says UAF and its partners are developing a business plan that would cut the estimated $5 million annual operation and maintenance costs, much of which went to paying for the facility's diesel-fired generators.
$5 million was a figure that we came up with based on information we had from the past and from information we got from the Air Force. What we've been looking at lately, the last campaign that was run there by DARPA a few weeks ago was run on a shoestring. So we think they may be able to run it much more economically.
McCoy says the business plan would be modeled on many of the same practices that UAF employs in the operation of the NASA-owned Poker Flat rocket range. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
A unique smell has been wafting through parts of Nome this past week, but it's not your typical summer fragrance. It's the smell of bear urine. And it's part of a new plan being tested to keep musk ox herds out of town. Tony Gorn is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Nome.
We routinely, almost daily, now move musk ox, but then they come back. So this is an attempt to maybe put out some type of deterrent to prevent them from coming in so close to town.
He says the agency has tried it all, rubber bullets, firecrackers, even aircraft. Now the tension with tensions in Nome mounting as herds of the animals are continuing to congregate and threatening dogs and property, Gorn is trying a more natural incentive to coax them to leave.
Some of the groups, at least, of muskox are moving close to town is because they're trying to find a bear-free zone. So really the idea is make it appear like there may be bears in the local area and maybe they would move back out. It's absolutely not tested yet, but it's worth a try.
Gorn says the urine has been applied to two sites where people have had run-ins with the herds. However, Nome's windy, wet climate is proving a challenge for implementation. But where do you buy or harvest bear urine?
Well, you can buy it commercially. So the internet's a wonderful thing.
Gorn has been in contact with other biologists that deal with muskox, but says Nome's situation on the Seward Peninsula is unique, and it's a polarizing issue for residents. Some people are frustrated by the threat of herds in their backyard, while others like the experience of living close to wildlife. The muskox population on the Seward Peninsula has been declining by about 13% each year. Boats returned in March to the newly rebuilt A&B Harbor in Sitka, but it wasn't until just last week that local officials cut the ribbon on the project. KCAW's Greta Mart attended the ceremony to learn what people thought of the finished product.
Hold it tighter. We'll pull it tight. Oh. Well done.
Marcus Lee of Lee Craft made the new archway and sign that now marks the entrance to the marina, installed last Wednesday. He said it took him about 3 weeks to build.
It's all done with a Scotch-Brite and a grinder, and the colors are stained, except for the mountain, which is stainless, and it's heat-colored with a torch.
In 2012, the Alaskan legislature approved up to $4.25 million in state funds to help completely rebuild Sitka's Alaska Native Brotherhood Harbor. City staff estimate the total cost of the job was $7.5 million. Mayor Mim McConnell was pleased with the outcome.
A&B Harbor has been heavily used by the fishing fleet for since it's been built. It really, really badly needed to be replaced. So it's what's there now is just such a huge improvement over what was there, what they were putting up with for so many years.
A&B Harbor was built in 1956, although almost all of the docks and floats torn out over this past winter were installed in 1974, with bits and pieces updated in the 1990s. The state of Alaska deeded A&B Harbor to the city and borough of Sitka in 1992. 2 years ago, the city's master plan described the condition of A&B as fair to poor, with just 5 more years to go before it became unsafe and unusable.
I've been here, you know, over 50 years, and I don't remember them ever, you know, doing any major work to the old A&B Harbor. Yeah, it's really nice. Everything's brand new.
That's Michael Baines, the chairman of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. He joined Mayor McConnell, State Senator Bert Stedman, and city staff for the ribbon cutting. Stedman said he was pleased with the rebuild and plans to keep working on funding local projects.
There's still some discussion on how we're going to upgrade the waterfront here over the next decade or so. We're going to have a build out down by the Centennial Building, clean that up and enhance that. So we're not done.
Besides the 92 commercial vessels moored here, the newly built harbor will soon accommodate 2 float houses. Last month, the Sitka Assembly approved a pilot project to see if floating homes will be a workable solution for affordable housing in Sitka. But a brand new harbor comes with a price. Moorage for boats here is now slightly less affordable. Sitka Harbor Master Stan Eliason said fees in the new A&B Harbor are now $2.80 a foot and will rise incrementally over the next few years. But as he washed down his deck, the captain of the fishing vessel Yentna said he couldn't be happier with his new and improved digs.
I love the new dock. I was displaced when they tore it out and had to go way out to the end of Eliason. So yeah, I got my old spot back and the docks are higher, so it's way easier to step onto the boats. They're pretty nice.
Nice, as long as you don't have to take a shower.
That's the one thing they did not improve was the bathroom facility, and unfortunately, it's just as bad as it ever was.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Greta Mart.
Southeast Alaska's largest electric utility has merged with a Washington-based energy company. Alaska Electric Light and Power in Juneau is now a subsidiary of Avista Corporation, headquartered in Spokane. The deal closed on Tuesday. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports.
Avista purchased AEL&P's parent company, Alaska Energy and Resources, for $170 million. At closing Tuesday morning, Avista issued about 4.5 million shares of common stock to AERC shareholders at just under $32.46 a share. The mid-size utility sells electricity and natural gas to nearly 700,000 customers in eastern Washington, northern Idaho, and parts of Oregon. With the purchase of the Juneau company, Avista Utilities acquires an additional 16,000 electric customers. AEL&P Consumer Affairs Director Debbie Driscoll says they will not see any changes in day-to-day operations in the short term.
Part of the contractual agreement was that when the deal closes, everything remains as is or better for the next 2 years.
That includes retaining AEL&P's Juneau headquarters and its more than 70 employees. Avista Communications Manager Jesse Wurst says Juneau may not be the company's only entry into Southeast Alaska.
We're an investor-owned utility, so we're always looking for opportunities to bring value to our shareholders. And Southeast Alaska is certainly an area that has opportunities in it, so we're looking.
Wurst says 51% of Avista power generation comes from renewable sources, including hydroelectric, wind, and biomass. Avista also owns part of a coal-based generation plant in Montana. The company started as Washington Water Power on the banks of the Spokane River in 1889. AEL&P was founded in 1893. The Corbis family bought into the utility in 1896 and has been majority owner since. When former AEL&P President Bill Corbis announced the Avista agreement in November, he said the company provided the best cultural fit. Driscoll describes her fellow employees as excited about the merger, especially for the financial resources the bigger company brings.
We've just expanded our resources significantly. There are changes in the industry, innovative improvements in the industry, smart grids, things that we can possibly now afford, and maybe before it would have been too much of an impact to our customers from a rate standpoint.
AEL&P operates Snettisham and Lake Dorothy hydroelectric facilities, as well as several smaller hydro projects and backup diesel generation. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur and Shaq Tulik, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jennifer Ruckel in Nome, Greta Mart in Sitka, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Joaquin Palomino reported from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at alaskapublic.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.